I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Adam Grant is an organizational psychologist at the Wharton School whose research and books have challenged our assumptions about how our minds work and why we do what we do. In his new book, Think Again, The Power of Knowing What You Don't Know, he writes about the value of constantly questioning our assumptions and beliefs. Grant says we can find joy in finding out that we're wrong, that it's possible to talk across the many divides that separate us, that thinking like a scientist will serve you better than behaving like a politician or a prosecutor or a preacher. I spoke with Adam Grant at a WHYY member event this week, and today we play back portions of that interview. Adam Grant, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. It's great to be back, and I hope you don't rethink your enthusiasm.
Never, never. Why is this a good time? Under the stresses, the uncertainty, the fears, frankly, of the pandemic, to begin to reevaluate our beliefs, our knowledge, our ideas. Why is the time right now?
I think 2020 was the year of forced rethinking, right? We had to question all these assumptions that we've taken for granted for most of our lives, like that it's safe to eat indoors at a restaurant, that we can hug people who aren't in our bubble, that we could possibly get anything done while our kids are in online school at home, right? Something we never even had to think about before. And my hope is that in 2021 and beyond, we do our rethinking more proactively, more intentionally. How many people over the past year have said, you know what, this is not the right career path for me, or I'm living in the wrong city and there's actually somewhere else I'd like to be. I think if we don't wait until we have to question ourselves, we can actually do it a little bit more on our own terms without the uncertainty and without the fear.
I also wonder, though, with fear and uncertainty, there is the impulse to hold on to those things, even if they don't work for us, but to hold on to them because they feel familiar. You know, it's what we do. How do we challenge that?
Well, I think we have to start to prefer the discomfort of doubt over the comfort of conviction.
That's hard.
And yeah, it is hard. It's really unpleasant for a lot of people, but it's short-term discomfort, right? I think that one definition of discomfort is growth. You're being stretched and you're expanding your comfort zone. And I think that a lot of us have done that in critical periods of our lives, right? I think about the value of higher education. I used to think it was about just instilling knowledge. Now I think it's more about teaching students how to think and how to rethink as well. And you know, I know when I got to college, I had to question a lot of beliefs that I thought were pretty important to my life and came out deciding, you know what, that's not who I necessarily want to be. And I think we should seek out those experiences as opposed to being dragged into them.
Where, though, did this idea for this book come from, the idea of rethinking things? And I wonder if there's something even in your own experience, your life, something serious that you had to rethink that you thought, you know, there's something rich to explore here.
Yeah, I've had a lot of moments where I failed to rethink and regretted it. So one of them was when I was a high school senior. I had a dream. I grew up in Michigan, and I had a dream. I woke up one morning that I had gone to Harvard, and on a whim, I sent in an application. No intention whatsoever of leaving the state of Michigan, had never considered applying out of state. And the dream was in late September, and I just wrote an application, sent it off, and really mostly forgot about it. And then this thick envelope arrived, and I was shocked. And I thought, I got in, I have to go, but I don't know if I'll have any friends there. I might be the dumbest person in my class. Let me find out what this experience is going to be like. So I went to the state-of-the-art technology at the time, which was America Online. I started searching profiles to see if I could find future classmates. And I found a few, and we created a little email list so that we could get to know each other. We started adding people every week. And by the time we arrived on campus for college, we had connected more than 1/8 of the entering freshman class.
1/8. Wow.
1/8. And some people called it Harvard's first online social network. And then we thought, you know what? We're all in the same town now. We don't need an online network. We have a physical face-to-face network. And we shut it down. And 5 years later, Mark Zuckerberg started Facebook in the house next door.
Why are we then so wedded to our ideas and beliefs? I mean, why do we cling to them as if our life depends on them?
I think some of it is ego and some of it is image. I don't want to look in the mirror and admit that I was wrong because I have to face the fact that I might be less intelligent than I thought. And I'm especially worried that everyone else is going to think that I'm not that smart. I think we have a bias, especially in Western culture, where when somebody changes their mind, we see them as a flip-flopper or we see them as wishy-washy, as opposed to saying, hey, you know what? When somebody revises their opinion, they might be learning something. They might be evolving their knowledge or their expertise. And I think that the people are afraid of being accused of lacking integrity or having been ignorant. And they don't realize that that saying, I don't know, or I was wrong, actually signals that you have the security, right? The confidence in your own abilities to admit what you don't know.
It's interesting to think of that in light of, you know, politics or almost any aspect of the world that we live in. And it's true. If someone very publicly says, a very public figure says very publicly, you know, I was wrong, it's pretty rare, to be honest with you, when that happens. But maybe that's why we don't hear it much, because you have to be so confident.
I think so. I think it requires, I don't know if anyone ever completely overcomes insecurity, but it requires at least putting it aside and saying, okay, I'm here to try to show that I'm confident enough in my expertise and my abilities that I can tell you all the things that I don't know. And I'm not going to treat that as, you know, as a chink in my armor or something like that. I wonder if, you know, we seem to judge people's integrity by consistency. And I think we should judge it much more by values and principles. So one of the examples that jumps to mind for me is, let's take Abraham Lincoln.
Sure. Anytime.
Lincoln came in, he's always a good choice, right? If we want to learn about leadership. Lincoln came into the White House convinced that if he abolished slavery, it would tear the Union apart permanently. How lucky are we that he changed his mind? He wasn't changing his values, though, right? He was always interested in trying to abandon this horrendous, inhumane practice. But he had to rethink what his policy was and what the right timing was and the right way to implement that. And I think what we can take away from Lincoln is, first of all, if Lincoln were leading today, a lot of people would probably be trashing him for his inconsistency. But what Lincoln teaches us is that you want to be true to your principles, but flexible in your policies, right? You want to have a set of values that are relatively stable and consistent, but be as open-minded as possible when it comes to what's the best way to implement that value or make that a reality.
In fact, he brings in, there was a book called Team of Rivals about the critics or the people who opposed him that he brought into his cabinet. And you write about the need that we all have for that outside critic, for that person to challenge what it is that we say we believe.
Yeah, I think we all have a support network. We know who to go to when we feel discouraged. We have a group of, you know, people who cheerlead, who encourage us, who reassure us. But I also think we need a challenge network. And that is critical to rethinking. Your challenge network is your group of most thoughtful critics, the people who believe in your potential and care in your success. The people who believe in your potential and care about your success so much that they will tell you the things you don't want to hear, but need to hear. And one of the things I did after writing Think Again was I reached out to a bunch of my most thoughtful critics. And I said, hey, I consider you a founding member of my challenge network. Then I had to explain what a challenge network is. And I said, I know sometimes I haven't taken your feedback well. There are situations where I've been defensive. There are other times when I've just been on a path and it seemed like a distraction and I dismissed it. But I've always valued the fact that you push me to think broader and deeper. And if you ever are worried that you're going to damage the relationship or hurt my feelings, don't. The only way you could hurt my feelings is by not being honest with me.
In fact, you say the great presidents, and you know, maybe we could argue who's in that pantheon of greatness, but that great presidents do a version of that, that they know what they don't know.
Yeah, there's a whole line of research on this by Dean Simonton and then a group of political scientists and psychologists who've actually gotten bipartisan panels of experts to independently rate the presidents on greatness. And you get political scientists, you get historians. And after doing those ratings, you then do separate personality ratings of the presidents. And you see that the most reliable predictor of that consensus score for presidential greatness is how mentally flexible a president is. How much they were interested in engaging with new ideas as opposed to just sticking to the tried and true way of doing things. And what's interesting is some of these presidents, like Lincoln, were unpopular in their era because they were pushing people to rethink convictions that they held very strongly. But with the benefit of history and hindsight, we can see that that was critical progress for the nation.
Let me ask you about something completely unrelated to Abraham Lincoln, the Dunning-Kruger effect that you write about. And this is this idea that incompetent people tend to see themselves as very competent. You also write about the imposter syndrome, which in many ways seems like the reverse of that, where you feel like, I'm a fake, I'm a phony, I'm going to be exposed because people are going to see I don't know what I'm talking about. Help us understand, I guess, the two sides of that issue.
Yeah, the original Dunning-Kruger finding is that the people who are least knowledgeable or least skilled are the most overconfident about their knowledge and skills. So the people with the lowest emotional intelligence are the most likely to overestimate their emotional intelligence. And I think part of what's interesting about this is it's not just ego, it's information. If you're not emotionally intelligent, you don't know what emotional intelligence looks and sounds like. And so it's very easy to claim that you have it. It reminds me a little bit of a friend of mine in high school who accused me of not having a sense of humor. And I asked her why, and she said, well, you never laugh at my jokes. I'll leave it to you to judge who lacked a sense of humor. But
right.
I think the version of this that I see all the time is the armchair quarterback syndrome, where a football fan is screaming at the coach for calling the wrong plays. And it's usually the fan who knows the least about football who's doing that, because the person who really understands the game knows how complicated it is and knows how much information a coach is working with and how much uncertainty is being handled in that moment. So the opposite of that overconfidence is the imposter syndrome. And if being an armchair quarterback means your confidence is higher than your competence, thinking you're an imposter is the reverse. It's your confidence actually falls below your competence. And Marty, I think that one of the mistakes a lot of people make is they see this as, well, we even call it imposter syndrome. It sounds like a chronic debilitating disease.
It sure does. It's a negative, isn't it?
Yeah. That's the way it's been presented and described in our culture. But I don't know that many people who walk around with a permanent sense that they're a fraud, that they've never earned any of their achievements, and everyone is going to find out that they were faking it all along. There are a few people you might know like that, but most of us, we just have everyday imposter thoughts where we doubt ourselves and we say, I don't know if I'm up to this challenge. Maybe I'm a little underqualified for this position. And we have a former doctoral student at Wharton, Basima Tewfik, who studied this. She's now on the MIT faculty. And she found that having more frequent imposter thoughts does not make you a worse professional investor. It does not also make you a worse doctor. It actually has benefits that if you doubt yourself more often, you're more likely to feel like you have something to prove and work harder. You're also more likely to feel like you have something to learn and work smarter. And so I've come to believe, this is still early research, but I've come to believe that there's value in slightly underestimating yourself, having your confidence a little bit below your competence, because then you don't get complacent and you keep realizing, you know what, I am not the most knowledgeable person in the room, and let me go and keep rethinking things and discovering things from the people around me.
We'll get back to my conversation with Adam Grant after this very short break. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let's get back to my interview with Adam Grant, organizational psychologist at the Wharton School. His new book, Think Again, The Power of Knowing What You Don't Know, is about the value of questioning our beliefs, the joys of admitting we're wrong, and the tools we need to enable us to talk with someone with whom we disagree. Well, let's talk about being wrong, which, most of us, probably you, Adam, we don't want to be accused of being wrong or being found out. I certainly have felt that on the radio, and my listeners call me out, and that's totally appropriate, but I don't like it. I want to be right. I want to be correct. But you have a chapter, and it's titled The Joy of Being Wrong. How does that work? How do we get to that place?
Well, this has been a struggle for me. My nickname as a kid from my friends was Mr. Facts.
Mr. Fact.
Yeah, Mr. Ouch. Facts. It was not a term of endearment, I found out later. Then I had a friend in middle school who said, we were in the middle of an argument. I think it was about a movie line. And he hung up the phone on me. I called him back. And he said, shut up, Adam. I won't talk to you until you admit you were wrong. I went back. I watched the movie. I was wrong, and I still didn't want to admit it. I really wanted to be right.
I feel it.
I'm so glad I'm not alone in that feeling. I think the turning point for me in many ways was a presentation I gave at a conference a few years ago. And the Nobel Prize winning psychologist, Danny Kahneman, was in the audience. And he came up afterward and he said, "That was wonderful. I was wrong." What? I'm sorry, wait, did you just say wonderful and I was wrong in the same sentence? That sounds like an oxymoron. How could these two feelings coexist? And eventually I decided I wanted to dig into this. So I reached out to him, we sat down and I said, "Danny, I've got to understand this." And you should know, Danny is a pessimistic person.
And he's a not Princeton, somebody right? Who, at Princeton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just one of the greatest social scientists in history, and you know, not somebody who is exuberant and upbeat in a typical conversation, but his eyes lit up in that moment and he looked excited. I said, "Danny, you seem to enjoy being wrong." And he corrected me. He said, "I don't know anybody who enjoys being wrong, but I do enjoy finding out that I was wrong because it means that I'm now less wrong than I was before." And that was a light bulb moment for me. I said, "Oh, Danny, this is my favorite thing about being a psychologist, is discovering that I was wrong. It's the best way for me to know that I've learned something." And Danny said, "It's the only way I ever know that I've learned anything. Because if I was right, I've just affirmed what I already believe. There's no learning there." And I think that's where the joy of being wrong comes from. It's a moment of discovery. It could be a rush. It could be a thrill. And where I've landed is that the faster you are to admit that you're wrong, the faster you can move toward being right.
And just a quick follow-up, you write about, and this is the part about the joy of being wrong, which is you need to detach, as you write, detach your present from your past, your opinions from your identity. I mean, pull those things apart.
I don't think it's easy. Let's start with opinions and identities. You mentioned earlier that we tend to get stuck thinking too much like preachers, prosecutors, and politicians, right? Preaching, I'm right. Prosecuting, you're wrong. And politicking, we're right, and the other side is wrong. And what I prefer is to think a little bit more like a scientist. And when I think about being a scientist, I'm not suggesting, Marty, that you should go out and invest in a telescope collection or a microscope or even walk around in a lab coat. Although I do think it would be nice if we had more Bill Nyes in the world walking around in white
lab coats.
But
yes.
Yeah, that would be fun.
When
I say think like a scientist, I just mean that we want to value humility over pride and curiosity over closure. And a good scientist doesn't let their ideas become their identities. So when you have an opinion, you say, "You know what? Just a hunch, just a hypothesis. I've got to go and test it." And that means I need to search actively for reasons why I might be wrong, not just why I must be right. I need to listen to opinions that make me think hard, not just the ones that make me feel good. And I need to surround myself with those people who challenge my thought process, not just the ones who validate my conclusions. And I think it's easier said than done, but just distancing a little bit and saying, "All right, this is something I think, it's not who I am, and I don't have to believe everything I think," is a decent starting point.
Well, speaking of right and wrong, as we all know, we live in a deeply divided country where, you know, we're divided over politics and religion and race and culture. I mean, it's a long, long list. And in many ways, we're, you know, we see the other as not just the other, but as someone alien or dangerous, our enemy. How do we engage with someone that we disagree with, what feels like on almost all levels? Is that possible?
I don't think it's impossible. And frankly, I don't know what the alternative is, Marty, because if we're going to decide that we just don't engage with people who don't think like us, we're choosing not only to stay polarized, but to live inside an echo chamber or a filter bubble. And if we want other people to escape theirs, we have to venture outside of our own too. I think one of the most powerful things that I've learned is when we talk about charged issues, we tend to oversimplify them. In psychology, it's called binary bias, and it's the tendency to take a whole messy, complex spectrum of attitudes and kind of simplify it by forcing it into two extremes or two categories. And we see this on all our divided issues right now. I think the problem is that when, you know, then we say, "All right, you've got to see the other side has the exact opposite views to yours. And it's so extreme that you can't even begin to engage with it. So whenever somebody says, this is us versus them, or they show me one side and then they show the other side, my first question is, well, what's the third angle? And what's the fourth perspective on this? I want to complexify the conversation so that people aren't locked just into one camp that's obviously better than the opposite camp, but they can start to see all the nuances in their own thoughts. And you know, you can see this on climate change, where most of the news is about the people who are alarmed and the people who are absolute deniers. But there are at least four other subcategories along that spectrum that capture most of Americans, from skeptical about whether climate change is, is human caused and is really a big catastrophic problem, to, aware of some of the problems, but maybe not sure that we need to act immediately, to concerned, to, wanting to take action, but not being sure what the right solutions are. And if we open up all of those different belief systems, we give people a chance to detach from their one extreme camp and say, well, I have some views that fit over there and some that fit in a different bucket. And now I'm a little bit more open than I was before.
Do you think the press, as you mentioned, you pick some issues that get a lot of coverage on the press, but that the press has that rather binary view and setting up complicated issues, but saying there's this side and then there's conflict with that side?
Yeah, I think that I used to believe that seeing the other side was the solution to the polarization problem. Now I think it's actually part of the problem. And just a quick experiment that I think illustrates this nicely is Peter Coleman did this brilliant experiment in his Difficult Conversations lab, where he brings people together to talk about abortion and they have opposite views. And the question is, will they consider writing and signing a joint statement about their shared perspective, which is a tall order for people who are on opposite sides of the abortion debate? What he does first is he gives them a different article about a completely unrelated topic, which is gun rights. And if he presents it as both sides and says, here's the case for gun rights, here's the case for gun safety, less than half of people end up finding common ground. If he takes that same information about the gun issue, and instead of saying, here's one side, here's the other side, says, here are the same facts, but he frames them as, hey, there are many different perspectives. This is a complex issue. And some people are in favor both of a Second Amendment and of stopping school shootings. Then 100% of people write a joint statement and find common ground. And that's a great example of complexifying, to say, if you can see the problem not as two sides of a coin, but through many lenses of a prism, then people become a little bit more mentally flexible.
I'm going to read a question from Paul, but just also a reminder that for those of you listening to us, and I'm glad you're here, we also want your questions and your comments, and we're covering a lot of territory, but we want you to be part of the conversation. Paul asks, Adam, you write that you've been rethinking, quote, strong opinions loosely held, and maybe I haven't made it far enough in the book yet, but what's the alternative given this approach was previously recommended, not to mention a way I was raised? This idea of strong opinions loosely held, what does that mean?
Yeah, so the idea is, and it's extremely popular in Silicon Valley, among other places, is you argue passionately for your views and you argue like you're right, but then you listen like you're wrong. The problem with that view is, and that approach is, that when you argue strongly, people tend to assume you hold your views strongly. And sometimes they feel prosecuted and they either attack back or they go into defense mode. And you both sound really stubborn and there's not a lot of rethinking that goes on. I think a good alternative to strong opinions weakly held is strong values, weak opinions. I want to be clear about my principles. This is like the Lincoln example we were talking about earlier. And I want to learn from you whether my opinions about how to live by those principles are right or wrong. They might be incomplete. They might be inconsistent. There are always new things I'm learning about what opinions I want to hold. And now what I'll do when I come into a disagreement or a debate with someone is I'll start by saying, hey, I have a bad habit. Sometimes I go into prosecutor mode and I've actually been called a logic bully. I bombard the other person with reasons and facts, and I don't want to be that person anymore. I want to have a thoughtful discussion where, hopefully I have something to share that you hadn't heard before, but I also get to learn something from you. So if you catch me going into logic bully mode or prosecuting you, please let me know. And I've actually had people call me out when I do that. I just had a colleague the other day say, hey, Adam, you're lawyering again. You might want to stop it and practice what you teach, which is a great chance for me to course correct. But also, I've noticed that when I do that little preamble, the other person will often say, I am the most stubborn person on earth, and I'm trying to overcome that. So if you could help me, we could probably both have a better discussion. And then we've both committed right at the start to, you know, to being a little bit curious and a little bit more humble.
As you say, a argument or conflict is when it, I guess, works better, is more like a dance than it is warfare. So it looks more like the two people are in concert together.
It does. This is a metaphor that psychologists have used for years, and I've really failed at it over and over again. Is I've come into disagreements armed for battle. I want to have airtight logic and rigorous data, and it's kind of my job as a social scientist. Right? If somebody has an opinion that I have, you know, I have strong evidence that it's false, I've felt for a long time that it was sort of my moral responsibility to correct them. And the problem is that I'm telling them what to think, as opposed to helping them rethink because they believe that it's worth doing. And yeah, I can't dance, but if I could, I would know that in a dance, you cannot lead every step of the way and just assume your partner is going to follow you. What you have to do is look for ways to get in sync. And that's what I think you do in a good disagreement.
Well, let's talk a little bit about motivational interviewing. And actually, Adam, you have a little script in your book, which we'll read together. This will illustrate what motivational interviewing is all about. I'm going to play me, which I guess is you, and you're going to play an uncle. Do you want to set this up for us?
Yeah. So I love this idea of motivational interviewing. And whenever I talk about it, people just, they're like, show me. I want to see how it works. And so finally, I thought, all right, I'm gonna write out a fun version of this. Imagine that you're a student at Hogwarts and you're worried that your uncle might be following Voldemort. And this is what you would do if, Marty, you're the motivational interviewer. I guess I'm stuck being the uncle here. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
I'm ready. I'm on page, is it 146?
It's 146, 147.
Okay. I'm ready.
I'd love to better understand your feelings about he who must not be named.
Well, Marty, I guess I'd say he's the most powerful wizard alive. And also, his followers promised me a fancy title.
Interesting. Is there anything you dislike about him?
Well, not crazy about all the murdering.
Well, nobody's perfect.
Yeah, but killing is pretty bad.
Sounds like you have some reservations about Voldemort. What's stopping you from abandoning him?
Honestly, I'm afraid he might direct the murdering toward me.
That is a reasonable fear. I have felt that too. Now, I'm curious, are there any principles that matter so deeply to you that you'd be willing to take that risk? So that is motivational interviewing. Take that apart for us, Adam. What did we just do?
Well, what I heard you do is a couple things. Number one, you are not trying to advance an agenda here. What you're coming in with is humility and curiosity. You're obviously concerned about my allegiance to Voldemort.
Yes.
But you don't know exactly what my stance is and what I think. And you're really curious to find out. And so you're trying to instead of, you know, bullying me into changing my mind, you're trying to uncover my own motivations for changing my mind.
You have looked at people that are skilled negotiators and people who are less skilled, and you saw some interesting differences between the two. I think it's a little bit related to what we were just talking about how to talk to people, frankly. Help us understand that.
Yeah, so whether we're talking about a skilled negotiator or, you know, motivational interviewing comes out of counseling psychology, but is now used in all kinds of professions. I think the idea is that you are coming in a little bit more like a scientist. When somebody has a different set of views, this is kind of an alien species. How interesting that somebody sees the world that way. I must know more. And then, you know, I'd love to find out, you know, what are your reasons for staying the course? What are the possible reasons you consider for changing? When you look at expert negotiators, one of the things they do differently from their peers is they spend a lot more time anticipating areas of agreement, looking for common ground. which is kind of neat.
That's surprising, but interesting.
Yeah, it's surprising to a lot of people who see negotiation as a win-lose activity, kind of like a debate. But what the experts realize is that, first of all, if you are going to disagree with someone, you want to start by agreeing with them, because then you establish yourself as a reasonable person. If we have common interests and common values, then, you know, I think I could probably get on the same page with you a little bit more. And I don't think you're being a jerk or you're being selfish when you make a proposal that's not good for me. They also know that most of the world is not a fixed pie, and it might be possible to find ways to help you and help me at the same time. Or there might be something you value a lot that I value a little, and then it's an efficient trade for something that you know, that matches on the flip side. The other thing that, well, of many things, another thing that expert negotiators do that I think applies to this kind of motivational interview is they avoid these defend attack spirals.
Defend attack.
Yeah. Yeah. So I won't come in and immediately attack your views or, you know, tell you that mine are better, right? I'll put out a proposal and then I'll say, you know, I'd love to hear what you see as the pros and cons of this proposal. And what I'm doing there is I'm trying to highlight your own ambivalence. Normally, if I put out a proposal and it's not exactly what you want, you would say no. But by asking you, well, what do you like and dislike here? I'm trying to help you recognize and say out loud, well, you know, there are some aspects of this that I would consider. And that's the same thing that we did in the uncle conversation about Voldemort, right? What are the things that draw you to him? What are the things that make you concerned about him? And then you want to amplify the what's called change talk, which is the set of reasons to consider the new direction.
We'll talk more about vaccine hesitancy with organizational psychologist Adam Grant after this short break. His new book is Think Again, The Power of Knowing What You Don't Know. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. And today on the show, my interview with Adam Grant, organizational psychologist at the Wharton School. We've been talking about his new book, Think Again. It's about the value of questioning our long-held assumptions, the value of learning to live with the discomfort of doubt, and how we can find joy in correcting our discredited ideas and beliefs. Right before the break, we were talking about motivational interviewing, which includes open-ended questions and focused listening. You write about he's a pediatrician, I believe, in Quebec, who, I'm going to say his name, Arnaud Gagneux, I hope,
yeah.
Something like that. He talks with his patients who are reluctant about getting vaccines for their newborns. What does he do? How does he do that? How does he, I guess, convince them to do what it is that they didn't initially want to do?
So Arnaud is one of the pioneers of applying the science of motivational interviewing to vaccines. And he has remarkable data showing that a single conversation in the maternity ward can significantly increase the number of parents who were reluctant who ultimately decided to vaccinate their kids. And even 2 years later, you see an impact of one conversation. What he does is he starts by saying, look, you know, I know that a lot of parents come in here with some mixed feelings about vaccines, and that's understandable. It's a complex world. There's a lot of information out there. Some of it is true, some of it is not. It's very hard to sort it out. And he says, I'd love to understand your views about vaccines better. And then usually the parent or the parents will start to explain their perspective. And he says, look, I'm not here to judge you. I'm not here to tell you what is best for your child. I want the best for your child, and I know that you do too. And it's up to you to decide what that is. And I trust your ability to do that.
Wow. And that works?
And it's usually a long conversation where he does a lot of listening, a lot of asking questions. There's a journalist who did some of the early reporting on Arnaud's work and said, he's like a less abrasive Socrates. Which I thought was a great description. He's not abrasive at all. He's so patient and so endearing. And he doesn't have an attitude of superiority. Right. What he'll do is when you tell him you have some concerns about vaccines, he'll listen. And eventually in the conversation, when you've shared all of your views, he'll say, you know, obviously this is an issue I've been looking into a lot as well. Can I have your permission to share some of my knowledge? And then what he'll try to do is not debunk all of your views, but say, you know, you've shared a range of concerns. There are some that I think are valid based on the studies I've read. There are others that, you know, seem to be misinformation. And let me share with you what I've read about that. And, you know, let me know if you have any questions about that. Mm-hmm. And you're free to choose whatever you think is best for your child. I respect you. And that's it.
And that's it. But I wonder how much is just the way he poses his questions, but also the kind of disarming personality. So, you know, modest, self-effacing, whatever, you know, that the not-so-angry Socrates. How much do you think that helps?
I don't know. It's a great question. I would love to see the test of Arnaud's questions with a different style or a different personality. I do know the overall technique of motivational interviewing has been evaluated in thousands of clinical trials. The effects are pretty consistent across the board, although it is more effective if it's used by a professional like a counselor or a therapist or a physician who's trained in the skills. And so I think there is something about that non-defensive, non-prosecutorial, non-judgmental attitude. And that's something you have to practice, right? I've actually been working on this a lot, trying to overcome my inner logic bully.
Oh.
And there are so many
He's
moments.
He's still there, right? He's still there.
Yeah, I mean, it occupies a part of my brain. And I, no matter how hard I try, there are times when I just want to say, like, I get that you're citing an individual study, but in science, we have this tool called meta-analysis, which is a study of studies where we correct for the biases in individual studies. And, you know, if this is a well-studied topic, a single study is not that meaningful. And I'm like, wait, no. This is not the way to open people's minds. This is a way to shut them down. What I need to say is, you know, you may know a lot more about, I just had a conversation with a friend who has some strong opposition to vaccines. And I had to catch myself. And I said, you know what? You know a lot more about vaccines than I do. You've read a lot more. You can cite your sources. My question for you is, who do you think knows more about science and how to, you know, how to accumulate knowledge and analyze studies? And he said, you do. Like, I don't know anything about that. I said, great, let's put together my knowledge of, you know, of how to design a rigorous study with your understanding of, you know, the vaccine data, and let's see if we can find some common ground here. I don't think he's getting a COVID vaccine tomorrow, but it was the most thoughtful and nuanced conversation I've ever had with him about vaccines.
Interesting. Let me just do a quick follow-up, then we got some more questions for you. Taking this vaccine hesitancy, and I'm sure, you know, you have seen Dr. Fauci, all sorts of public health people on television talking about vaccine hesitancy and trying to convince those people who are reluctant that they should vaccinate themselves for get a vaccination for themselves and for the larger community, for their loved ones. Is there a way you think they can frame that that would get over some of this hesitancy? Now, that's not a one-on-one. It's talking to the nation, but a way to do that.
Maybe. I think the empirical jury is still out, but some of the early evidence is interesting. I guess the first thing I'd say is I did some research in hospitals years ago where I found that doctors and nurses were more likely to wash their hands when we reminded them that it would prevent patients from getting sick, not that it would prevent them from getting sick.
Wow.
And we did that because
seems counterintuitive.
It is. It's the opposite of what you would expect, that people would act for their own safety first. But there's an illusion of invulnerability that we see, that people think, you know what, I'm not going to get it. I'm good. They don't want to admit that their own health is at risk. But when it comes to a vulnerable population, like a patient in a hospital, it was a lot easier to recognize that they were in fact at risk. And sure enough, in the early days of the pandemic last year, don't spread it was a more effective message when tested than don't get it. But that was only true in the first month of the pandemic. And then as the message got out, it stopped working because it wasn't novel anymore. There are a couple other messages that might be effective from some of the new data that I've seen. One is that we all have a responsibility to reciprocate the sacrifices that healthcare workers have made
That's
by putting
powerful.
Themselves in harm's way.
This is Bruce who says, Arlie Hochschild talks about the deep story and how people don't have the right to believe their deep story. When you have the knowledge, they are wrong, how do you engage in respecting their deep story? Do you know what he means by a deep story?
So Arlie Hochschild's a brilliant sociologist. I think we're talking about her book on strangers in their own land. And yeah, this is the hardest place to get people to rethink, is when you are very confident that they're wrong and they are very confident that they're right. I don't know that I have a silver bullet here. I do think, though, that one of the things that I've learned is if you have people who are very attached to a view, they're not going to just naturally take your perspective. But sometimes you can get them to shift their perspective. So you know from the book that I did some experiments with Red Sox and Yankees fans, trying to get them to stop hating the rival fans. And I recently did a version of this with people on opposite sides of the gun debate. So this is research with Tim Kundrow. And what we did was we said, all right, Yankees fans, who do you think you would root for if you'd grown up in Boston? And all of a sudden, they realized that this deep-seated animosity they had toward Red Sox fans was sort of an accident of birth or upbringing. And then when they realized that if they had been born in a different city, they could hold different allegiances, they stopped defining people in terms of the team they rooted for, and they actually showed less hostility toward them. So we did a version of that with people in the gun debate, and we said, if you're a passionate defender of, you know, of the Second Amendment, what views do you think you would have? How do you think you would look at this problem differently if you'd been raised in Columbine? And we also did with people on the opposite extreme. If you're passionate about gun safety, what do you think you'd think about guns if you'd grown up in a serious hunting family?
Dan asks, how can rethinking become an attribute that the public finds desirable in a politician in a time when many voters might prefer a leader seen as firm or resolute? We touched on this earlier, but I think it bears some further discussion.
Yeah, I don't know that the public actually prefers that. I think we prefer it because it's hard to find good role models of what I would call confident humility. Confident humility is that quality we were talking about earlier of being secure enough in your strengths that you're willing to disclose your weaknesses and admit what you don't know and what you got wrong. And it's one of the things that I've seen in some of the most effective pandemic leadership over the past year. I think Jacinda Ardern is a wonderful example of this in New Zealand. I think if you look at her early speeches, they went into lockdown very quickly. They've obviously been effective in containing COVID in ways that a lot of countries weren't. And one of the things I hear over and over again in those early messages from her is, we don't know. We don't understand yet how severe COVID is, how it spreads, what it's going to take to prevent it and to stop it. And because of that, we're going to play it safe and not take any risks here. And we're going to learn new things every day. I might find out that some of our assumptions were wrong, and then we're going to change our plan. And I think one of the things that I would love to see more leaders do, especially in politics, is to identify upfront what conditions would change their mind. So right now, you know, a lot of people on the right are critical of the CDC for reversing their view on masks.
Exactly. Right. I was thinking of that. Yep.
I mean, it's such a frustrating example for me because the CDC completely missed the opportunity to announce their initial guidance and say, based on the current data, it seems that masks are not necessary, but there is a lot we don't know. And if the following three things were to happen, we're going to shift that view. And that way they don't sound like hypocrites. They're actually teaching you how science works.
Here's something Lauren writes. She says, as an evangelical who voted for Biden, other evangelicals automatically assume I support X, Y, and Z liberal stances. They can't accept that I've applied a lot of scriptural principles to actions and words of the past president that led me to not support him. Any advice for engaging with my friends?
This is always dangerous to give advice to strangers. I don't even like giving advice to myself, but if I had to look at the evidence here, I would say that one of the most thoughtful conversations you can have is to start by asking, what are the principles that you look for in a leader in general? And just start with a broad definition of what you think is important when it comes to the values of the people that you would look up to and admire. And then I'd probably go next to the question of, okay, if we were to look at somebody who was running your workplace or somebody who was teaching your kids in Sunday school, what are the things they could do that would violate those principles? And what I'm trying to help people realize themselves when I ask those questions is that loyalty to principles matters more than loyalty to people. Right, that they would say, in order to be true to my values, I actually have to abandon my attachment to a leader in certain circumstances. And we all have deal breakers. And so if you can lead them to that conclusion on their own terms, they're a lot more likely to think through those conditions and say, yeah, it would be pretty dangerous to blindly follow someone just because they happen to belong to a particular group or party.
Phil asks, are you a student of Stoicism? He says your comment about walking from Marcus Aurelius to Socrates to Donald Rumsfeld. Let me just quote something. And I have to say, when I saw the title of your book, I was thinking of what Rumsfeld said, Secretary of Defense, a number of years during the Iraq War. And that full quote is, this is him, it was a very controversial and kind of mind-boggling thing that he said. I'll quote
it. This is the unknown unknowns quote?
Yeah, yeah. Let me just do it. Reports that say that something hasn't happened are always interesting to me because, as we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know, but there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know, we don't know. Based on your research, Adam, is he correct?
Yes, of course. I think this is the most important thing Donald Rumsfeld ever said. And he got crucified by a lot of people for it.
He did.
As if he was saying something that didn't make any sense. Like, how can you know what you don't know? Well, I know that I don't know a lot of things. I know that I'm ignorant about how in the world your voice is being transmitted into my ears right now. Like, I don't understand the physics of that. Do you?
No, not at all.
How long have you been in radio?
I know nothing.
This is still a mystery to me. I don't get it.
I told you, I know nothing.
I think you know a little more than you let on, but you know, I know nothing about financial markets, about chemistry, about food, about fashion. Right? You can be aware of your own ignorance, and it's extremely dangerous not to be. There's an old idea in psychology that I think foreshadowed what Rumsfeld was talking about there. It's called the Johari window. And yes, I guess this is an era in psychology when you name things after the Joe and Harry who created it. So it literally got called the Johari window because of their first names, if I remember correctly. Anyway, it's a 2x2 matrix where you look at the knowledge you have of yourself and then the knowledge that other people have of you. And they observed that the riskiest place to be is in a zone where other people know things about you that you are blind to yourself.
There's a lot of that, though, don't you think?
I think the world is full of those moments. Our lives are full of those moments where we can't see ourselves clearly. Right. And it's not just the bad stuff, right? The blind spots are the weaknesses we can't see in our own thinking. My favorite bias is the I'm not biased bias, right? Where you can see the flaws in other people's thinking, but no, you know what? I'm immune to all that. I'm good. My thinking is perfectly logical and rational at all moments. But there's another kind of blindness that I think is interesting, which is sometimes people are blind to their strengths, not just their weaknesses. I think that, you know, that's a version of being an imposter. To come full circle on that is to say, okay, other people think I'm highly capable and I genuinely don't believe it. How great would it be if more of those people ran for office?
Adam, we're going to leave it there. That seems like a high note to end on. Adam Grant, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Honored to be here, as always. Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. That was Adam Grant, author of Think Again, The Power of Knowing What You Don't Know, recorded earlier this week at a WHYY member event. Our thanks to the WHYY team who made this interview happen. Emily Kinslow, Tina Kalakay, Adam Stanishevsky, Frank Feller, Shenga Tab, Gary Lindstrom, and Diana Martinez. And the Radio Times team, Debbie Builder, who produced this interview, John Ahrens, who edited the interview, and Kelsey Hansen, who does our social media. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.